Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, 10 days and counting until a city council vote on the Charlotte 2040 plan, and still no consensus seems to be emerging. We're beyond any consensus being achieved between the county commission and the school board. Their disagreement over funding heads to mediation. Pat McCrory misses out on Donald Trump's endorsement in the race for Senate. And David Tepper decides against the Dome Stadium, but he does want a new one, and he's expecting your help. Here to bring us up to date on those stories and more is Steve Harrison, WFAE's political reporter. Steve, welcome back.
Hey, good morning, Mike.
Good morning. Jonathan Lowe is a reporter anchor for Spectrum News One. Good morning, Jonathan.
Good morning, Mike.
Katie Peralta Soloff is a reporter for Axios Charlotte. Good to see you again.
Good morning.
Good morning. And Eric Spanberg will be joining us shortly. He was with us a moment ago and then dropped off our Zoom line. But Eric Spanberg is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. As the country has quickened the pace of its reopening and as mask mandates have fallen, as we get a handle on COVID vaccination rates, the reason that we're getting a handle on this virus, people getting vaccinated, all of that is slowing down. So around the country, states and municipalities have been offering incentives for people to get vaccinated. Last week, Governor Cooper was in Charlotte to offer $25 gift cards at some vaccination locations. But yesterday, he made an additional announcement expanding incentives.
When we know the vaccines are the key to getting this pandemic fully behind us, we need to pull out all the stops and do everything that we can.
So, as several other states have, the governor announced a $1 million COVID-19 vaccination incentive lottery. When does it start? And how does it work? Who wants to take that? Go ahead, Jonathan.
So, not sure when it, I think it starts immediately, but as far as how it works is, you know, you basically go get your vaccination and then you're entered into a lottery. You know, in full disclosure, I'm a bit cynical about this because I think this is overlooking all of the people who went and got their vaccination without having to be incentivized for it. And, you know, $1 million is a lot of money. And you think about all of the vaccine hesitancy, and to think that, oh, now that $1 million is in the pot and up for grabs, what changes with that hesitancy in people's like political beliefs about the vaccine and then, you know, certain historical concerns that people may have? All that.
Well, you're not alone. You're not alone. You're not the first person who said, gee, I got my vaccination without any incentive. Why? How come these people who have been slow to take this free shot get $1 million or a shot at $1 million? But Eric, hold on. I'm still talking. There is good news for those who've gotten their shot. And that's what I think you're chiming in on, right?
I was just going to say, I just had a quick question, actually, Mike. I thought everyone was thrown into the lottery drawings.
Yes, that's the good news. Everybody who's gotten a shot gets a shot at $1 million. But everybody who goes to get a shot going forward is entered twice.
Yes, that's the bad news.
It's a little bit kind of like the public radio model of, you know, sustaining vaccination. People are already entered in the lottery. So, the first one starts, I believe the first drawing is June 23rd. Then there'll be every other Wednesday, four times. If you judge the lottery by traditional lottery odds, it's pretty good. You have a 1 in a million chance at $1 million. And then your real play, though, is the 12 and 17 year old bracket. Because you've got about a 1 in 41,000 chance. So if you can kind of like work either with your own kids or work together with someone else's kids, that's the angle. Those are the best odds.
But as I understand it, those between 12 and 17 have something else at stake. It's not the $1 million. It's $125,000 for college. Is that right?
That you are right, Mike. So yeah, rather than the million-dollar bonanza, you have to settle for going to college. So yeah,
and it's not just one shot at $1 million. They're giving away $4 million here. Where's all this money coming from?
It's coming from COVID relief money, federal money. So they're using some of the federal recovery money to cover the incentive pool, if you will.
So 54% of people in North Carolina have received already at least one dose of this shot. 50% are fully vaccinated. 46% in Mecklenburg County have received at least one shot. Of course, Joe Biden and I think the governor both aiming for 70% vaccination rates by July 4th. Only 13 states have hit that mark so far, and we're not on track. So officials are saying the low vaccination rates in the South, throughout the South, are posing a danger to the country, particularly with the 4th of July holidays coming up and vacation season coming up. They're worried that people coming here from other parts of the country will be infected because people are not getting vaccinated. So how well are these incentives in other states working? How have they, are they helping improve the rate at all?
I mean, I think in Ohio, Ohio was one of the first states to start this idea.
Million-dollar thing. Yeah.
Correct. And incentivizing getting your vaccination. And I believe, you know, overnight, it was like a 28% increase in the number of people that got their vaccination. So it works. But I just go back to, you know, 6 months ago when we were first talking about this vaccination, and there was so much just vitriol against COVID and simple protection measures such as social distancing and wearing a mask. And to think that that all goes out of the window just because you get a beer or you get a donut or $1 million, just it doesn't really connect for me at least.
How did the $25 gift certificates or gift card incentives work that came into being last week? I think four counties, including Mecklenburg, were part of that pilot program. Did they have any, was there any movement, Katie?
They, you know, state health officials are saying that, yes, it is helping to increase interest in vaccinations. They also are giving away these gift cards to people who drive individuals to get a vaccine. Cooper yesterday mentioned the effectiveness of this program and said that they will be expanding it to additional counties moving forward. So, you know, so you've got $25 gift card opportunities. You've got $1 million lottery. There's free Krispy Kremes. There's free beer. There's, you know, all of these like perks that people are kind of throwing out all the stops trying to kind of figure out what works. They're throwing a lot at the wall to see what'll stick. You know, it seems like they're kind of upping the ante each and every time we talk about vaccine incentives.
So I think you just answered my next question, which was, has anybody done an analysis on return on investment? Because when you're talking about $25 gift cards, that's one thing. But when you're talking about giving away $4 million and a chance at $125,000 college scholarships for 12 to 17 year olds who get the shot, will this ever work to incentivize people who don't trust the science, who have a different political point of view about the virus and the shots, and people who are maybe just in general anti-vaxxers of any kind? Will this ever work for them?
I mean, I think that the most effective way to get people to take the vaccine, if they're really, really, really hesitant about it, if they don't understand the science, if they are scared to put something in their body that they don't, fully comprehend, is talking to your physician or talking to healthcare professionals to understand what it means and the benefits of it. I think that maybe this could get people off the fence who just were putting it off and they just were busy or lazy or they didn't feel like doing it, but they don't really care about it otherwise. But for those individuals who are legitimately scared or nervous, I'm not sure if this is really going to tip the scale. And that's why you see so many physicians really spending quite a bit of time with their patients, doing a ton of outreach that otherwise they wouldn't be spending time doing on, you know, a normal vaccination. But this is an effort to just educate people on the importance of these things.
But of course, in the United States, where healthcare is sketchy for people who don't have health insurance, you may not be spending any time with a physician talking about the importance of these shots. That may be playing a role in this too, but it also, we seem to be ahead of the rest of the world on this, where they do have healthcare. So I'm not sure what the problem is. We have been living under a series of executive orders since, I think, about a year or so from the governor in terms of what can be open and what you can do and what you cannot do. And the executive order under which we are operating now, Steve, is set to expire today, and the governor is expected to announce something new to be put into its place as of today, sometime this afternoon probably. Do we have any idea what Governor Cooper may be announcing?
You know, he was asked about that yesterday during his news conference about the vaccine lottery, kind of asked repeatedly, like, what's coming? What are you going to do? And, you know, his basic message was tune in for today. I want to talk about the lottery right now. I don't know what's coming, but, you know, in theory, really, I mean, all restrictions are off. I assume really only the next step is to kind of move away from this emergency state of affairs, because there's nothing left to do. Yeah, there's no rules left. So why not?
And this kind of follows, Mike, really quickly. South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster just did this earlier this week. So it kind of falls in line with what our neighboring states are already doing.
So whether you're vaccinated or not, the restrictions are falling and we're opening whether we're ready or not. And I guess we are. But the city council and county commission, as a sign of things changing, are back in the government center for their meetings. And the council met on Monday, but they met in a conference room. I think they allowed people into the conference room and overflow into the actual chamber. Why did they choose to meet in the conference room and not the big room?
Well, you know, this was the meeting on Monday was a strategy session at which historically, Mike, they have held in the room you're referring to as 267. Now, as far as the need for overflow, there weren't that many people, speaking of the public, that attended. The media, of course, we were there. It was our first opportunity to be in the building since the pandemic started. And basically, other than other city staff that were in the room, the media that was there, and there really were no other members of the public there.
So at Monday's meeting, as it unfolded, the conversation turned once again to the Charlotte 2040 plan. For many members, including Renee Johnson, it was deja vu all over again.
I said it last week that this feels like Groundhog Day.
And let me tell you, Renee, we don't disagree. So with that in mind, we introduce our new 2040 plan update theme.
Then put your little hand in mine. There ain't no hill or mountain we can't climb. Babe. I got you, babe.
I know that's a little long, but... for those who may not understand that reference, that's the song that Bill Murray woke up to every morning on his alarm clock in Groundhog Day. So there is a close split on council. Some have described this as a bitter divide over at least one part of the plan, actually many parts of the plan, but one in particular, the zoning changes. Is the term, Eric, bitter divide an accurate description?
I would say that's more than accurate. That might even be euphemistic at this point. so, I mean, as everyone is saying, it looks like it's going to be a 6-5 vote. And one of the things that's interesting about this, Mike, is that for so long, this process went along. No one really paid attention. No one really cared. And then all of a sudden, everyone sat up and said, oh, my God, we're about to vote in April. And they've been fighting ever since. They had a 4-hour, sort of knockdown, drag out on Monday night. They really didn't change much or do much, and they're in the same kind of locked battle position, and that's where they'll be on June 21st when they finally take the vote.
Well, I know you're all going to find this difficult to believe, but there's more to talk about this argument over the 2040 plan, and guess what? We will when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, the local news roundup featuring Steve Harrison, our political reporter here at WFAE News, Katie Peralta-Soloff, reporter for Axios Charlotte, Eric Spanberg, managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal, and Jonathan Lowe, reporter anchor for Spectrum News. We find ourselves talking once again about the 2040 plan. For months, the council has been discussing one particular part of this plan, it seems, and that is the proposal to allow duplexes and triplexes in heretofore areas zoned strictly for single-family homes. It's a 6-5 split. Despite the split, it looks like this is going to pass, the 2040 plan, and that has the mayor concerned because she would like to see more consensus on council to get greater buy-in with the public. But City Councilman Malcolm Graham has a different take.
I think if we pass this thing with 6 votes, no one's going to give a damn that the day after it passes. They want to know, what are we going to do to build a better community? That's what matters.
So does the council split reflect sentiment within the community? Is the community equally divided, or are they paying any attention at all, Steve?
Well, it's hard to say because, like Eric said earlier, this has been going on for many months, and a lot of times, you know, many people didn't pay any attention. But I think one thing that's interesting about the split on council, this 6-5 split we talk about, is that generally, the people who are concerned about the plan represent districts. They represent the small city council districts and are, in a theory, more responsive to their constituents. The majority are either running for at-large seats or represent people at large. And so I think that is a little bit of a tell, because if you represent a district, you are doing what you believe your residents want.
And will people remember this? Because the elections for city council are coming up in, we'll talk about this later, but they're coming up in March of 2022. Will people remember this if they're not in favor of this, or if they are in favor of this, or will this simply be a distant, misty memory?
I think for a lot of people, it would be a distant memory. But I think, you know, obviously, as with anything, those that are most directly impacted will certainly remember it. Developers will remember it. Neighborhood activists will remember it.
One of the other points of friction in recent weeks on the parts of many on council has been the fact that they feel that their suggestions to city staff, as they've been discussing changes to, that would modify parts of the plan, have simply been ignored. Here's Republican Ed Driggs.
We can't be working in an environment where we, as the elected representatives of the people who have ultimate responsibility for this, feel that we are not able to put forward modifications to this plan and just have them implemented.
Have changes submitted by council to staff been ignored in subsequent drafts of the plan?
So this came up specifically regarding the aspect of the 2040 plan that deals with 10-minute neighborhoods, basically mm-hmm. saying that services, goods should be within a 10-minute bike ride, walk, or ride on public transit. So it was interesting to see Councilman Beccari brought this up and said, you know, basically, we took a straw vote in this, and I asked for this specific references to biking, walking, or public transit to be taken out. So then we come back this week, Monday night, and it still had those different modes of transportation in there. So then he was like, well, let's see what the transcript from the prior meeting said. I think it was on the 24th. So then City Manager Marcus Jones reads through the transcript, and almost word for word, the transcript matched what Councilman Beccari said on Monday night, saying, you know, kind of lending evidence to the fact that, no, it wasn't changed by the planning director or planning staff that are working on this 2040 comprehensive plan. And so that kind of boosted Councilman Beccari's argument. And it's an argument that not only he brought up, again, you know, you mentioned Ed Driggs, but Renee Johnson was on that side as well, saying that we have asked for certain things to be changed in this plan. We have taken straw votes on it. And then we come back the next meeting and it looks exactly the same.
Here's Tariq Beccari.
They don't care. They want to jam something through that they designed in the beginning, and that's it. And if they can do that on something so simple as this, that's why I can't trust anything else in here.
Wow. I think he was specifically talking there about language that he wanted included about advanced technologies being used to make deliveries as part of that 10-minute neighborhood portion of the plan. But a lot of people on council evidently are upset by this. Is it unusual for things that they discuss and they direct city management to put into play to not make it into draft form, at least?
I'd say... I would say that I've covered a lot of councils, and there is always a dynamic where city staff sees the elected officials as somewhat of an annoyance, right? They do what they want to do and they think it's best. However, I've never seen it to this degree where the city staff basically ignores council the way they have on this plan. I mean, it's just really unusual. I've usually there are some accommodations made, but in this case, it is just like, they hear talk, and then thank you very much, and very little changes.
And to add to that, go ahead, Mike.
I was just going to say that the staff works at the behest of the council, but council is political, and they change every 2 years. Is this a matter of we'll outlast the so-and-sos?
Well, yeah, and I think to Steve's point, there's always a degree of this because a lot of people who are close to city government always say that the staff really runs, you know, they run things because they are there forever. You know, the bureaucratic theory, so to speak. But this is different. I mean, what you just heard, that clip and some of those exchanges that Jonathan just mentioned, that's a different level than we've seen in the past.
Well, that's what I was thinking, too, because the mayor also thinks that things have gotten out of hand, and she has been encouraging people to tone down the rhetoric and be more respectful of each other, and she did it again on Monday night.
It's very difficult to listen to the disparaging remarks. They extend beyond this issue, but this issue has made them very real and very ugly.
We had hoped to talk to the mayor earlier this week on this program, but she bowed out of that appearance within hours of being here. So we didn't get a chance to talk to her. But is this parental role on the part of the mayor something new, or has this been done by previous mayors with council?
I think this is a little bit new, but it's certainly not new in the recent history. I would say the past, certainly the COVID period, maybe even before that, but the past 15, 16 months, anyone who's been watching these meetings, this has happened again and again with the mayor sort of sighing and hanging her head, just, you know, frustrated beyond belief that she can't get the council to be more respectful, to stop arguing. We've seen this pattern again and again. And I do think, you know, we're always at the risk of what's happened the latest to be the most or the biggest. But I do think this is a different level of dysfunction than we've seen in quite some time with the council.
I want to point out that the split, the 6-5 split, is not a partisan split, although the two Republicans are part of the negative votes in that 6-5 split. There are three Democrats in there as well. This is not a partisan issue, but what is also emerging in these conversations is something that we're witnessing about government in general at the national level, and that is a sense of distrust in the process. Malcolm Graham, who we've already heard from, who supports this plan, expressed confidence in the process with those opposed being distrustful. So when did being on the losing side of an argument immediately call into question the validity and the integrity of the process?
I don't think that the people who are on the losing side are questioning the fact that they're on the 5 votes, the other people have the 6. They're upset that on some of these earlier straw votes, they had 9 votes. They had all the votes. And these things that they put forward aren't showing up in the plan, kind of like what Jonathan talked about. And that's where you feel a real sense of frustration on this council. Now, the people who even the majority may have wanted things in the plan, but it's not there. They're not going to make a big deal. The plan has to pass. This has to pass. The city has put so many chips in on the 2040 plan, so they won't rock the boat. But I think that's what it's about.
And watching, you know, at the end of the day, Mike, you just wonder what, you know, you come away from this wondering what is the point of these straw votes? If you all are having these long drawn out conversations on critiquing these different items and different policy points of this plan, you take a straw vote, excuse me, and you come back to the next meeting and the discussion is exactly the same. You leave wondering, well, what was the point of that prior meeting and taking that straw vote?
And why do they keep recycling? If they've already voted on it, if we do this, we will vote this way. Why do they come back to it?
Absolutely.
I'm asking, do we know why they're doing it? Are we stuck in a loop? Is that what's going on here?
We're stuck in a loop, and I think there's some wishful thinking going on where the council thinks that they are, you know, what they say and what they want in this plan goes, and it doesn't, and the city staff thinks that, no, it's the way we see it, and there's, you know, they're butting heads on it. And
Eric,
can I just be the bearer of more good news? Remember, as we go through this, a lot of this is aspirational, as we keep hearing. You know, it's not fully binding, but you still have the Unified Development Ordinance that is binding, that does still have to be negotiated. And I'm just going to use past as prologue. That should go swimmingly based on what we're seeing right now with 2040.
Well, I was going to bring that up, we've gotten into problems with specificity on certain things. Like, for instance, there is this argument about one of the suggestions in the plan is to spend 50% infrastructure spending over the next 20 years on vulnerable neighborhoods, which led Mayor Pro Tem Julie Iseult to say that 50% seemed like an arbitrary number. It also seems like a big number. I'm curious as to whether or not it is a big number. But this plan is not going to be the end-all, be-all. It's merely an aspirational, non-binding plan that will guide the development of the Unified Development Ordinance, which is coming next. That will be binding, correct?
Correct. That's correct. Now, you know, to, I guess, give a little slack here, you know, there is the idea of setting the tone, and, you know, words do matter, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not like this thing is meaningless. There wouldn't be this much argument and fighting about it if it was meaningless. But I do think there is a point to be drawn that if they're having this much trouble with the piece that is less powerful or less binding than the next step, that does not bode well.
We've also had back and forth on building heights downtown and community benefits and how that language should be worded and whether or not that language should be in the plan at all. The council is scheduled to vote in 10 days on June 21st, not this coming Monday, but next Monday. And Mayor Lyles has cautioned everyone on council there is still time to make changes. And in fact, the council can amend the plan right up until their vote on June 21st. But its passing seems assured. Is there likely to be any movement among the 6-5 split? Will we see a 7-4 split ultimately, or something different?
I don't think so. Not based on what we saw on Monday.
And before moving on, there was also discussion about Amazon as a floating refrigerated warehouse delivering groceries to food deserts, which Tariq Bakari believes we are about 10 years away from. What was that all about? Where did that come from?
So, I mean, this was sort of I think he was being theoretical in talking about Amazon and floating warehouses. And his discussion was basically around 10-minute neighborhoods and how ultimately there will be technology to solve some of the problems that we're grappling with right now. However, shaping city policy around hypothetical Amazon decisions is pretty staggering when you think about it. However, it's kind of not surprising for Charlotte. I think that the point here, I mean, Tariq always brings up, like, you know, self-driving vehicles and how technology could shape some of the equity issues that Charlotte grapples with. I think the point is, you know, there could be better solutions down the road than just having all of these neighborhoods connected, you know, by alternate means of transit. You know, if Charlotte can't right now get an Aldi in a neighborhood that doesn't have any grocery stores, it's hard to imagine that the world's most powerful company is going to immediately prioritize some of these neighborhoods. Who knows? I also don't know what a floating warehouse is. So I think that's a conversation for another day. I think the point is technology will catch up with us.
The floating warehouse is for when we put the river through downtown as a tourist attraction.
We got to cap 277 too to make all that
that's
happen.
That's right. All right. One of the other things that we haven't talked about recently is the budget. The city budget we haven't talked about at all on this program, but one of the things that is in the city budget is more money for police, and this kind of bucks the trend of less money for police going on around the country. Steve, the proposed budget for CMPD next year would increase by 3.7%, $10 million to $301 million. Is this a vote of confidence?
It is. And Mike, like you said, I mean, there has been a trend, not a majority of cities nationwide, but a significant number that have taken money from their police budgets. Asheville did it last year. They knocked out about $780,000. And remember, a year ago, we had that council vote to prohibit the CMPD from buying chemical agents. That was, a vote in the spirit of defunding. But then a year later, CMPD is getting $10 million more. And I think it's just interesting. Johnny Jennings, the chief, has kind of defanged the council and has got them on board. He has he's kind of walked a tightrope and no defunding here.
Yeah,
and
one of the things that came out in the article that you published today on our website, Steve, is the fact that Johnny Jennings has been seen now as being very cooperative with both council and with citizen activists. He has said essentially, if I remember what you wrote here, that if you come to him and demonstrate that the police can be doing something better, if he agrees with you, he'll make it happen.
That's right. Yeah, that's a feeling among council. And like you said, activists, Kerr Putney, his predecessor, I think, was a little more stubborn, a little more defensive on making police changes. And Johnny Jennings, I think, has kind of is probably a little more political and able to see that he has these issues that he has to deal with as chief. And if he doesn't, it's better for him to take the initiative than to be reactive.
We've been talking for weeks now about the 2020 census being the results being delayed, and that would impact the elections, and it's going to impact the city's elections because they were scheduled for this November. Now they'll be delayed until March of 2022, with the school board elections being delayed until November of 2022. Why the split? Why not just have them all at once?
Yeah, I think that's a really, really good question. Why not have them all at once? The bill working through the legislature specifically puts CMS in November. They could go in March as well. I think there were some concerns that because that's the day of the primary for, you know, Congress and U.S. Senate, that you might have a weird partisan mix that might influence it. But school board members are elected to 4-year terms. They will get an extra year. This will become 5-year terms for the district members. And that's a long time. And you talked about earlier, remember you said with the city and the 2040 plan, will voters remember this? There's a lot of big school issues going on that may fade away too.
We'll come back and talk more about these extended terms or shortened terms, perhaps. I don't know what it means going forward. We'll come back and talk about that in a moment at Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Steve Harrison is with us from WFAE News. Jonathan Lowe from Spectrum News One. Katie Peralta-Soloff from Axios Charlotte. And Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal. There's one more question about these city elections. They are supposed to be delayed until March 2022 for city council, November 2022 for school board. That passed through the House. It has to go through the Senate now. I believe the governor has to sign off on this to make this happen. And you've mentioned, Steve, that this will make some terms longer. What does it do to people elected in 2022? Because the next elections had been scheduled for the fall of 2023. Will they have shorter terms? Because the election cycle, at least for the city, is timed so that the new people come in and they do the work on the new budget.
You know, I believe that the election schedule will stay the same. So we will be back in 2023 with a new election. So, you know, there's always this idea that council only has 1 year to really work and then 1 year to campaign. So moving forward, this may be no year to work.
A lost campaign. Lost year, yes. All right. Despite calls for working together for the children, the impasse between Mecklenburg County Commission and the CMS School Board continues. The county intends to withhold $56 million in funding until the schools submit a plan to address low performance among minority students. The school board has essentially said, one, they have a plan. Two, the county commission is not the supervisory body for the schools. They are. And three, it isn't that the board can't show the commission a plan. It is that they won't. At a meeting on Friday, the two boards rehashed their positions. And for school board chair Elise Dashew, it's that the county is not being a good partner in all of this.
Your threats and your finger pointing and your misinformation campaign have real potential to harm our students.
But County Commission Chair George Dunlap says the county is within its rights to ask for a more concrete action plan.
This is a reasonable request so that the county knows how best to invest the taxpayers' dollars in education.
Everybody is butting heads at every level at every governmental organization. Has anybody heard from the public on all of this? Do they see this as interference on the county's part or simply as being good stewards of their money?
I think it depends, Mike, on who you talk to. There were, you know, I was at that meeting and there was a contingent along the back of the room. I'd say maybe 20 to 30 teachers who all seemed to be disagreeing with the county's position on this and basically saying that the county, using the term defund, they feel like the county is out of its bounds by defunding CMS.
Well, you heard Elise Dashew say it's going to hurt the children. And when Dina DiOrio testified, she's the county manager, about all this, she said that she was tasked by the commission to find a way to withhold money that would not impact the classroom. And she says this $56 million will not impact the classroom. So where's the disconnect? What's the truth here?
Well, go ahead, Jonathan.
So I'll just say that, you know, and Eric can add to this, but so it's whoever you ask about this. CMS will say that this has basically trickle-down effect and that they won't be able to provide, they'll have to move monies in order to, you know, they won't be able to pay raises for assistant principals, that they'll have to do some changing of the guard and move stuff around at central office. And that at the end of the day, as it relates to students and teachers, that they won't be able to provide raises to all teachers. Now, I don't know, CMS hasn't said specifically how many teachers that is. They just said all teachers.
Okay.
Now, the county will say that these are all positions that are tied to central office, meaning, you know, central office staff. So it depends on who you ask, which will depend on what answer you get.
So we'll talk more about this on Monday. Our entire program, we'll talk about this funding issue with people on both sides of the issue and try to get to the bottom of what it will really mean if these funds are in fact withheld. But they've moved now to mediation, as far as I can tell, and we'll know something about the outcome of that sometime, I believe, in August. The twice impeached ex-president emerged from Mar-a-Lago last weekend and came to North Carolina to speak at a meeting of the state Republican Party. And during that speech, we learned that the president's daughter-in-law, Lara, would not run for Richard Burr's U.S. Senate seat. We also learned who Trump is endorsing in the race, and it isn't former Charlotte mayor and former Governor Pat McCrory. Trump explained that in typical Trump fashion.
You can't pick people that have already lost two races and that do not stand for our values.
And that from a loser president. Instead, he chose Ted Budd. We'll talk about him in a moment. But was this an unexpected slap in the face of Pat McCrory? Steve.
I don't think it was unexpected, because if you go back 4 years ago, McCrory tried to get a job in the Trump administration and was turned down. And I think at the time, people vetting him had kind of raised flags about his loyalty to Trump. and whether he was sufficiently MAGA. I think McCrory had said during the campaign in 2016 that the president needed his mouth washed out after the Access Hollywood tape. So I think that, you know, because of all those things, this wasn't a big surprise. And Ted Budd is really MAGA. I mean, 100%.
Pat McCrory has also said that the efforts to overturn the results of the election were attempts to destroy democracy.
Is that what Donald Trump meant by not standing for our values?
It could be. Ted Budd is one of the Republicans who voted against certifying the results of the election. So if we're looking at just one issue, I mean, that could simply put both men on either side of a very obviously divisive issue, an important one for Trump.
As for Pat McCrory, he took this rejection by Trump in stride.
Endorsements usually have very little impact on how people vote, nor should they.
That's McCrory speaking to Fox 46. Is he right about endorsements and the importance of them?
I do think they tend to be overblown. I think it's also interesting from McCrory's standpoint. You know, he immediately pointed to former North Carolina congressman and chief of staff to Trump, Mark Meadows, and played the Washington insider card, if you will. And remember, McCrory's campaign is all about him being an outsider, even though he's a former governor and mayor and all that stuff. So in some ways, it goes along with the narrative that he wants to see.
And yeah, this is kind of a litmus test for how this race will pan out anyway. You know, we'll get to see how the former president's endorsement may help or hurt Ted Budd, or whether it will help or hurt, you know, the other two big names that are in that race.
McCrory did release this statement later on saying he was, quote, disappointed that President Trump has endorsed a Washington insider who has done more to oppose the Trump agenda than anyone in this race. We will win this race, the primary and the general. Is that true about Bud's voting record in Congress? Did he vote more for, well, in line with what Donald Trump wanted, or did he vote against Donald Trump's wishes? Do we know?
I think Ted Budd has been pretty much universal in his support of the president's agenda. I mean, there could be some instances where he differed, but he's been a very loyal Republican.
According to Axios Charlotte, to Katie, Ted Budd found out that Trump would endorse him from a Secret Service agent at that event on this past weekend. And Trump told the crowd that he liked that Budd hadn't courted his endorsement. But did he give any reasons why he endorsed him other than that?
I think it boils down to loyalty and agreement on the MAGA agenda, as Steve said. And those are obviously very important to Trump, and that's something that he highlighted specifically in front of that crowd. And his endorsement does carry a lot of weight for people who like him.
Pat McCrory has the best name recognition, I think this is true, of any candidate currently running, Democrat or Republican, throughout the state, because he was the governor, for crying out loud, and he was the mayor of Charlotte for 14 years. But Budd is one of 147 House Republicans who voted against certifying the 2020 election in January. So given the number of Trump loyalists there are in the Republican Party and the number of Republicans who incorrectly believe that the election was stolen, can Pat McCrory win enough Republican votes to win in the primary?
Why, I think that's why what Jonathan said is so true. You know, this really is a test of the strength of Trump and his base. The other thing that I'm really curious to see is Trump said, you know, I'm behind you 100%. I'll be here. So let's see, how much will he be here? Will he really come out and campaign for Budd be on the ground?
So the response of the Democrats running for their party's nomination for the Richard Burr Senate seat is what you would expect. Erica Smith said, quote, twice impeached, banned on social media, disgraced former president, endorses corporate lackey and insurrection apologist. Beaufort or Beaufort Mayor Rhett Newton says, quote, as a further implosion of the Republican Party, the former president endorsed the toxic and destructive Ted Budd. Even Lara Trump fully recognizes the sinking GOP ship and declines to run. Is that why she declined to run, Steve?
I don't know. I mean, maybe I don't. Well, all right. I will say it is not a sinking GOP ship in North Carolina, considering how well they did in the November election here. So I think that piece of it is false. But in terms of why she chose not to run, you know, there could be a million reasons. I mean, it is such hard work to run and, you know, a statewide campaign.
And it's very interesting, Mike. This was the you know, first time that the former president has appeared at an event outside of the state of Florida since he left office. And remember that the NCGOP convention with Saturday night where he appeared, Georgia had an event as well. He could have easily gone to Georgia where he has tried to have a lot more influence. And this whole recounting of votes and questioning of the election has been a lot more pervasive. You know, as Steve just mentioned, very good point that I think that the NCGOP is a lot more has a lot more influence when it comes to its connection to MAGA. And I would not count, you know, this whole thing, you know, implosion and infighting, intra-party fighting is, I think, how the state Democratic Party referred to it. I think that's a little bit more false than is true. The NCGOP in the state seems to be quite connected to the former president.
Well, okay, here's another sign that things are returning to normal. We have time to talk about building a new football stadium. Talk of the new stadium for the Panthers and for our newly acquired Major League Soccer franchise began this week when owner David Tepper started the conversation this way.
You know, at some point that building will fall down. Okay, so we would, you know, it's a question, like I said before, and I'll say it again, I'm not building the stadium alone. The community is going to have to want it.
So by that, he means we have to ante up. Is that right? Am I reading between the lines correctly there?
Yes, you have grasped the subtleties involved in ownership and new stadiums. By the way, that's
the opening shot. He just said, quote, at some point, this building is going to fall down. Well, yeah. Maybe 1,000 years.
By the way, Memorial Stadium, which is reopening next month, opened in 1936. So that's just
And then there's the Colosseum in Rome as well, yes, and the Empire State Building. He was referring to a 25-year-old concrete, reinforced concrete building. Is it just that we have the oldest stadium in the league and it's time?
Backing up a minute. Let's not forget that Bank of America has undergone like tens of millions of dollars of renovations, maybe actually hundreds of millions, of course.
180 million, yeah. And now another 50, Katie. Yeah.
Yep. So now to accommodate Major League Soccer, I think you could sort of consider these renovations a bit of a band-aid to make sure that the place stays, you know, up to speed and ready for what's next. They, you know, the Panthers have argued that this is the stadium is basically like a car. The minute you drive it off the lot, it starts depreciating. And, you know, these buildings, professional sports owners will argue, are the opposite of, you know, a home that appreciates. These depreciate over the years, or so they say. So what you know, the Panthers are going to want, what Dave Tepper is going to want, is eventually some state of the art, you know, beautiful, you know, Mercedes-Benz like facility to host.
And am I right in saying that when business people talk about a depreciating asset, they're talking about the fact they can't write as much off on their taxes, and therefore we need to buy something new and sparkly so we can start the process all over again? Is that essentially? I'm serious. I'm not joking here. Isn't that how it works?
Yeah, and that's the argument that the Panthers and plenty of other sports teams have used over the years when reevaluating the value of the stadium. They brought in an expert who said that the building had a lot of functional obsolescence.
You mentioned Mercedes, and that's the stadium in Atlanta, which is incredible. And there's no question about it. And it has a retractable roof. I believe it has. I know it has a dome. Initially, he was talking. David Tepper was talking about having a retractable roof, but now he is nixing that because in the era of COVID, he wants to be in the open air and sunshine, and because we have nice weather here. Well, that
was all kind of fuzzy, though, Mike. I mean, he said, I would never build a dome, but he was originally talking about retractable roof, and then they haven't ruled out retractable roof. So I'm not sure where they're going. I don't know where he was going with that.
Well, he also said, quote, if I'm paying a third, the community is paying a third, and eventually in the future, a long way out, the PSL owners will pay a third. That's a partnership. And if people don't want it, they don't want it. I'm not going to force anybody in on it. Is the legislature in South Carolina salivating?
They could be. I mean, this is always something that they could dangle. You know, we're perfectly situated between the state line where they could dangle this in front of both state legislatures to say who wants to pay for it. Historically, North Carolina state lawmakers have not wanted to pay for stadium upgrades, but we'll see if that changes.
So the first shot across the bow has been fired, as we knew it would be for many, 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 many years, even long before David Tepper came into the conversation. So we'll get our sounder for constant conversation about paying for a stadium ready for the future weeks to come. Steve Harrison from WFAE News, Katie Peralta-Soloff from Axios Charlotte, Jonathan Lowe from Spectrum News One, and Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal. Thank you all for the hour. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.